Okay, I think we're all set to go. We're going to discuss insurance, IFRS 17. The floor to Henry.
Great. Thank you, Hans. Good afternoon, everybody. So this afternoon, we are continuing with our plan for the redeliberations of the IFRS 17 amendments. And we're following the plan that we all agreed at our meeting last November. And this afternoon, we're considering four of the topics that you decided that meeting required further consideration of the feedback on the exposure draft, namely the scope exclusion for some credit card contracts. And Roberta and Liz, who is on the phone, I believe, will take us through that paper. We'll then turn to the risk mitigation option on transition, and Jin and Laura will take us through that. We'll then consider contracts acquired in their settlement period, and Laura will take us through that. Interim financial statements, Roberta will take us through that as well. And then the fifth paper that we have this afternoon for you follows last month's discussion on insurance acquisition cash flows, and it considers the related requirements on transition and in a business combination, and Vitalina will take us through that. So we're currently on target, and we currently plan to bring to you at next month's meetings the papers on the remaining technical topics that we decided required further consideration next month. And then to allow you just to take stock of the overall package of amendments that we're making to IFRS 17, we currently expect to ask you to consider the effective date question at the March meeting. So that's the current plan as we're seeing things at the moment. So with that, I will now hand over to Roberta to kick us off on the credit cards.
Thank you, Harry. So agenda paper 2A discusses the feedback on the proposed exclusion from the scope of IFRS 17 for some credit cards. Overall, respondents welcome the proposal in the exposure draft, but raise two main concerns. Those concerns are discussed in the paper, together with possible ways of amending the proposal to address those concerns. The first concern is discussed in paragraphs 19-32 of the paper and is related to the measurement of the credit card contracts that would be captured by the proposed scope exclusion. The exposure draft proposed that an entity would apply IFRS 9 to those contracts. No specific concern were raised about the measurement of credit card contracts providing insurance coverage only as a result of law and regulation. The insurance cash flows of those credit card contracts would not be in the scope of IFRS 9 because IFRS 9 focuses on contractual cash flows. Concerns were instead raised about the measurement of credit card contracts providing insurance coverage as part of their contractual terms. Respondents noted that a credit card contract might be viewed as a combination of a financial asset, to the extent that the credit card has been used, and an undrawn loan commitment, to the extent the credit card is unutilized. Only the impairment requirements in IFRS 9 apply to many loan commitments, and those impairment requirements would not capture the effect of the insurance coverage. Therefore, the measurement of those undrawn loan commitments would exclude the insurance component. The paper considers two possible approaches to amend the proposal in the exposure draft to address this concern. Approach A considers requiring an entity to measure the credit card contract in its entirety at fair value to profit or loss, applying IFRS 9. Approach B considers requiring an entity to separate the insurance component from the credit card contract and to apply IFRS 17 to the separated insurance component. On balance, the staff recommend approach B because it would achieve the objective of the proposal in the exposure draft to continue existing practice of not accounting for the entire credit card contract as an insurance contract. Approach B would also address the concern raised by respondents about applying IFRS 9 to measure the insurance component. So the first question for the board is set out on page 14 of the paper, and ask whether you agree that the board should confirm the proposed scope exclusion with some changes to address the concerns that I've just summarized. So I hand over to the board for the discussion of this third part of the paper.
I agree with the staff recommendation on question one of the paper. I think that the people that gave us the detailed feedback on this picked up a good point in terms of the gap we had in measurement for an undrawn credit card, and that this proposal deals with that well. I think another benefit of this is that whether or not the insurance coverage is provided as a result of regulation, the credit card piece gets treated in the same way, which I think is a positive. So I support this approach and the use of 17 where we can for an explicit contractual insurance component.
Campbell?
Thank you. I agree with the staff recommendation. However, one thing I will check is if the banks had to separate these two components. Then for accounting for insurance components, do they have to install a kind of a insurance accounting system? Yes?
Yes, because they need to apply IFRS 17 to that component. So.
But it looks like a very burdensome for those banks to install.
Well, we are talking here only about the population of the credit card for which a bank would choose to provide the insurance coverage. So it's part of the, we'll say, commercial activity of the bank of making this decision of selling insurance.
Well, I welcome the staff recommendation, but I had, in fact, a concern similar to Chumhu. Basically, we're still in the scope of those insurance contracts which are not priced, taking into account the specific risks of the policyholder. So I was wondering whether we could not consider that if there is no other use of IFRS 17 in the group for any form of reporting needs, whether and only in that case, whether instead of IFRS 17 could be dealt with through IS 37. Just to avoid implementing IFRS 17 in full just for this type of insurance activity, which is not very developed, because if you're not considering the risk, the specific risk, I mean, it's really not very developed.
I think the reason for which we are recommended to apply IFRS 17 to the separated component is that because IFRS 17 has been designed to deal with accounting, specifically insurance contract. And given that the insurance is part of the contractual terms and conditions, there might be various disparate type of insurance coverage included in the contract. So it might be, you know, travel insurance, maybe a variety of different type of insurance. And we think that IFRS 17 is the best standard to reflect the accounting.
And I agree with your assessment. But if, well, I would have a qualifier. I mean, I would support the requirement, but in case IFRS 17 is not used in the group for other activities, eventually IS 37 could be seen as simplification. Now, I say that reacting to your proposal and seeing it all together, where we call for IS 37 when in other instances, but I have no idea, to be honest, of whether that would be useful to many, just in case they exist.
Actually, based on the information that we have from the outreach, we know that most of the credit cards that have insurance attached are sold by banks in the capacity of an agent. Normally, there is then an insurance company that is the provider of the insurance coverage that is sold through the credit card.
And eventually,
in that case, the insurance risk is borne by the insurance company.
Daryl.
I've considered or thought about this argument as well during the reading phase of these papers, and I must say I've got very limited sympathy. I think, to my mind, those banks, as you said, Roberta, who have elected to offer this as a contract addition, they're doing it voluntarily, and typically they'd be doing it because they consider it a significant operation from which they expect to make profitable outcomes. To my mind, that means they are taking on significant insurance risk, and I think in taking on significant insurance risk, IFRS 17 is the best model we have for identifying and measuring that risk. If anything, the IAS 37, I think, is quite generous. And I think arguably that should be, but I understand why we've gone down that route, and I'm comfortable with that route, given the circumstances of the way IFRS 9 and other standards are written. But I think to try to sort of carve out exceptions like this, there are a number of motor vehicle companies that offer insurance with their product. I'd be inclined to say, well, what about them? And I think if you are choosing to offer an insurance product as part of your product offering, then you should account for it as an insurance contract, would be my view.
Any other questions? No, then we can vote. Who supports the staff's recommendation?
14.
Okay, so we can move to the second part of the paper. The second concern raised by respondents is discussed in paragraph 33-36 of the paper. Respondents welcome the board's intention to reduce IFRS 17 implementation costs by permitting the continuation of existing accounting practices for credit card contracts, and express the view that the board's rationale for proposing the scope exclusion for those contracts is also relevant to other similar contracts that are typically not issued by insurance companies. They suggested extending the scope exclusion to other contracts to avoid imposing cost and disruption for no significant benefit. So the staff agree with this view and recommend the board extend the scope of the exclusion to contracts that provide credit or payment arrangement that are similar to credit card contracts, if those similar contracts meet the definition of an insurance contract and the entity does not reflect an assessment of the insurance risk associated with an individual customer in setting the price of the contract with that customer. The second question for the board is set out on page 16 of the paper and asks whether you agree that the board should extend the amendment to other contracts that provide credit or payment arrangement that are similar to credit card contracts. I hand over to the board for the discussion of the second part of the paper.
Any comments?
Okay. Can I just make sure, maybe I'm too old to think about the new technology, but when I heard the name of the credit card, that sounds like more like a plastic card we usually use. But if we expand this definition, it clarifies that the company who use more like electronic accounts or electronic app, which have a very same term and condition, as explained here, can be within the scope.
Yeah, I think we are normally using the terminology of a contract, so credit card contract or, current account contract. I mean, it's always the contract, not the instrument itself. Maybe, I don't know, in 20 years a credit card would not be used any longer and everything would be through the app, so...
I think we're also trying to be careful to capture debit type arrangements.
Yes, also the debit card itself might be just the facility. The contract, the one that will be captured by the scope exclusion.
Changwu.
Thank you. Just clarification, I agree that the staff recommendation of clarification. In question two, do we still have that separation requirement to be applied here to as a question one?
Yes. It's provided by...
It's perfectly the same.
Yes, would be exactly the same.
Just clarification.
Yeah. Do we support the staff's recommendation?
14.
Transition.
Okay, agenda paper 2B discusses back on the exposure draft
relating to the risk mitigation option in the variable fee approach, and it's specifically relating to the prohibition from applying the option retrospectively on transition. At the December meeting, the board tentatively finalized the two amendments that were proposed in the exposure draft to address stakeholders' concerns on this topic. The first amendment related to a concern about the inconsistency arising in the comparative period, because IFRS 17 requires an entity to apply the risk mitigation option prospectively from the date of initial application. To address that concern, the board proposed an amendment so that an entity would apply the option prospectively from the transition date. The second amendment related to a concern about the inconsistent treatment of risk mitigation activities that took place from the beginning of the life of insurance contracts up until transition, compared to the treatment of risk mitigation activities after transition. To address that concern, the board proposed an amendment so that an entity that would otherwise have applied a full retrospective approach could instead apply the fair value approach. Applying the approach, risk mitigation activities are reflected in the CSM at transition in consistent way to how those activities would be reflected in the CSM going forward, applying the risk mitigation option. Despite this amendment, some respondents to the exposure draft continue to suggest that an entity should be permitted to apply the risk mitigation option retrospectively as an alternative to applying the fair value approach. The feedback mainly comes from specific jurisdictions in which some insurers predominantly issue variable fee contracts. Therefore, in the first part of the paper, the staff have analyzed respondents' suggestion to permit retrospective application without any additional conditions compared to the existing conditions in IFRS 17. When developing the exposure draft, the board concluded that permitting retrospective application of the risk mitigation option would come at a significant cost. In particular, it would risk cherry-picking. In the feedback from respondents, the STEP have not identified any suggestions to alleviate the board's concern about cherry-picking. Rather, those respondents think that the benefit of permitting retrospective application would outweigh the risk of cherry-picking. In addition, some of those respondents think that the conditions in IFRS 17 are already sufficient to reduce this risk. Accordingly, the STEP think that the board's previous conclusion continues to hold. In particular, we note the possibility of cherry-picking would in itself reduce the credibility of the information provided by entities, both on transition and in future periods. We also note that the conditions in IFRS 17 do not reduce the cherry-picking risk. Even when the entity has pre-existing risk management documentation, the entity would continue to have the choice as to whether to apply the option at all in past periods or when to start applying the option. Therefore, we recommend the board reaffirm its previous decision not to change the requirements in IFRS 17 as suggested by those respondents. The second part of the paper analyzes some respondents' suggestion to reconsider all-or-nothing approach. This approach does not have the risk of cherry-picking. The board considered this approach when developing the exposure draft, but rejected the suggestion due to the difficulties in proving the completeness of such an approach. In the comment letters, respondents suggested that they could prove completeness of such an approach based on existing risk management documentation they produced today. Considering that feedback in this paper, the staff have analyzed what an all-or-nothing approach would really mean. We think that to address the board's concern about cherry-picking, all must be considered at a reporting entity level. A level any lower could involve cherry-picking.
We also think that to address stakeholders' concerns about reflecting risk mitigation activities before and after transition consistently, all must mean all risk mitigation relationships for those variable fee contracts that exist at the transition date. And that would include both current and past derivatives or reinsurance contracts. After performing the analysis, the staff think that requiring entity to both identify all and measure all retrospectively would be an extremely difficult task, and it is unlikely many entities would be able to meet the high hurdle. Therefore, the staff recommends that the board does not introduce a new all-or-nothing approach. Since this paper was posted, we have received some feedback, which is consistent with the feedback that has already been considered in this paper. I will now ask the board if you have any comments.
You mean that feedback was consistent with the previous feedback, so was equally unconvincing?
Yes.
Martin?
Yes, thanks. And I agree with staff recommendation, and I think also thank you for your efforts. Because when we discussed it, I think earlier it was this idea of this all or nothing approach, and I think you have in detail analyzed that it is impossible, maybe some companies, but it's unlikely that a company will meet that, and therefore I think, okay, if it is unlikely, we should not amend the standard for unlikely events, and therefore I agree with staff recommendation, and especially because I think we have a solution which was discussed earlier with this fair value at transition date, and therefore I think that we should not amend that, because I think the concerns we raised earlier still remains and have not found an approach which overcomes it.
Sue? I also agree with the staff recommendation, and it is with somewhat of a sort of heavy heart, because I was hoping that we might be able to find a way to do more to help people in this area, but we really try to encourage people to come back with new ideas to help us, particularly on this cherry-picking aspect, and we got very little back. Most people said, don't worry about it, which isn't that helpful. Some people I know are not at all happy with the recommendation on the paper, so I just wanted to comment on a couple of the points that maybe they've reiterated and why I still have a difference of opinion for what it's worth. One of the points that people raise a lot is the fact that as long as we required an entity to who chose to apply the retrospective approach to continue to apply the risk mitigation approach going forward, that would somehow address the cherry-picking concern. And for me, that doesn't address the cherry-picking concern, because it still means that you could choose to reflect the risk mitigation for some relationships and not others, which could be achieving a particular CSM outcome. So I don't think the fact that you have to continue to apply it if you did it retrospectively addresses that cherry-picking issue, because it's the all-or-nothing aspect of it that we need to deal with the cherry-picking, and we haven't found a way to address that. I think perhaps the other thing that, and I was just looking at the paper again quickly, and it might be one thing that perhaps, with hindsight, if I was making a suggestion for this paper, we could have brought out a little bit more, is that I think one of the concerns that people have with the recommendation in this paper is they feel like we're taking away their ability to prove they can do all or nothing by saying we think it's unlikely and therefore we just shouldn't allow it. And I guess that does feel a little bit mean, but I think that that's because a number of the audit firms raised with us concerns about their ability to really check the completeness. How could they go back in time when there was no prior sort of hedge accounting type documentation requirements and really get assurance that everything had been captured? So it feeds into this all or nothing aspect of things, that somebody might say, well, look, these are all the documents, but they might just be all the documents they've, you know, it may not in fact be the complete population, because we're dealing with an odd situation. So I think the fact that to do this fully you need to go back to the life and all through it just creates such huge documentation challenges that while I would have liked to have done more, because of the importance of the CSM number, I have to agree with the staff recommendation.
Jian Chao.
Thank you, yes. I support the staff's proposal regarding to all and nothing approach. It seems that some respondents, they think that according to paragraph 29, they think that they could reasonably ensure the completeness of that approach. I wonder, because when I look at the explanation, what's the meaning of all, because it's very critical, what's the meaning of all or nothing. Actually, if the completeness will be assessed at the reporting entity level rather than portfolio and group level, the hurdle is very, very high. So I'm wondering whether when those respondents or entity mentioned they could reasonably ensure the completeness of this approach, whether they mentioned when they assessed that completeness, is that at the reporting entity level or portfolio level or group level? Didn't they mention it, or whether we test? Yeah.
So in the comment letters, we had feedback about the type of documentation that entities do have and have held in the past. But when talking about an all-or-nothing approach, I don't think there was sort of any specific talk about what all means. So no detailed analysis came in about what an all-or-nothing approach is.
Françoise.
Well, I'm totally torn on this issue because I understand and support both sides. So I think I am going to abstain.
Okay. Then we have a vote. Who supports that recommendation?
13 in favor.
An abstention.
Eight.
Yeah,
which counts.
Okay. 2C. Laura.
So agenda paper 2C discusses the feedback on the exposure draft relating to applying IFRS 17 to contracts that were acquired during their settlement period. This is one of the topics that the board considered when developing the exposure draft but proposed no change. The board disagreed with stakeholders' suggestions that would have created an exception to the general requirements in IFRS 17, specifically for those acquired contracts. The board did, however, propose a transition relief in response to concerns that entities would not have the information to apply the requirements retrospectively. That relief was tentatively finalised at last month's meeting. This month's paper analyses feedback which continues to suggest that those acquired contracts should be accounted for in a different way. The analysis is split up into a few parts. The first part discusses how IFRS 17 is applied to acquired contracts in the exact same way that it's applied to other insurance contracts. Those acquired contracts are, however, in a different position at the acquisition date than they were in at their issue date. Acquiring a contract to pay out claims for an event that has already happened is different to issuing a contract under which claims might occur. And so the outcome of applying the same requirements at the acquisition date is different. IFRS 17 reflects the position of the acquiring entity when it decides to take on those contracts. The second part of the paper then walks through some alternative ways that respondents suggested those contracts could be measured and presented. That includes one suggestion to create a new deferred liability outside of the measurement of the insurance contracts, and another suggestion to present any revenue on those contracts as a reduction in expenses. The staff think that the general measurement and presentation requirements in IFRS 17 provide useful information about contracts that were acquired in their settlement period. And when we were doing this analysis, we weren't persuaded that those alternative suggestions would provide better information. Adding new requirements specifically for those contracts would, however, add some complexity to the standard. The third and final part of the paper moves on to analyse specific concerns about insurers that expect to apply only the premium allocation approach to the contracts that they issue, and also an alternative suggestion to account for contracts acquired applying what is referred to as a business model approach. Overall, when considering the feedback and the alternative suggestions, we are recommending that the board reaffirm its previous decision to retain unchanged the requirements in IFRS 17. Since the paper has been posted, we have received feedback from some stakeholders disagreeing with the staff recommendation. Generally, those stakeholders disagree with the outcome of applying the requirements in IFRS 17 based on the facts and circumstances at the acquisition date for the acquirer. In particular, some stakeholders think that identifying the acquiring entity as providing a service for those contracts would overstate revenue. Those stakeholders said they would need to provide non-GAAP measures to isolate the effect of business combination accounting for those contracts. So I will now hand over to the board to discuss paper 2C.
Mika.
Thank you very much. I understand that if the entity acquires something through the business combination, that how they acquire and when they acquire should be reflected on the accounting treatment. So I understand that I have no basis for conceptual argument to bring that here, but I still have some sympathy with non-life insurers, those companies that otherwise would apply premium allocation approach to the similar contract ordinarily. So I think after reading the paper from the paragraph 40, I understand how this accounting will be applied to that practice, but I would like to make sure how you assess the operationality of the application in the those entities that otherwise would apply the PAA.
So I think in this paper, when we talk about entities that might be applying the PAA to all the contracts they issue, we focus in on the conceptual argument. You're right. So here we talk about, this is the bit in the paper where we have the sinking ship. So this is very much on the conceptual argument. I think the reason we didn't go into the practical side here was because when the board discussed this last time, about a year ago, at that point the board did discuss the cost and the benefits, including the cost and the benefits for those PAA entities. So I think both PAA entities and general model entities have told us this is complexity and cost. The difference with the PAA entities is they would be developing a CSM just for these contracts if they don't use the general model for anything else. But we didn't receive any new information in terms of the cost benefits that the board already discussed for both general model and PAA last time, so which is why here we just focused a bit on the conceptual.
Errol?
So I think where the feedback we got was useful in just people trying to see which particular ways of applying the standard might actually, or applying changes to the standard might work. But I think generally I agree with the conclusion. I think one of the objectives of IFRS 17 was to bring this industry more in line with other industries, and I think this is a big part of that process. I understand that in some circumstances will create operational difficulties, but I think these are limited circumstances, and entities need to, I think, work with that, unfortunately. That is a part of the process of getting their accounting aligned. In terms of the different options that were suggested, I think whether we end up with what people are talking about as higher revenue than perhaps they would like, or whether we're talking about lower expenses, I think in either case we have a number that is different to what it would have been had the acquisition not occurred. And I think there's nothing, as I understand it, that would stop an entity from providing additional information if they felt that would be helpful to people to understand the future cash flows they are likely to get from these transactions. In the same way, there's nothing to stop entities who have this problem in other industries from doing the same thing. So I'm supportive of where the staff have landed on this.
Martin?
I mean, I also agree with staff recommendation, and I think this is not unique to insurance business. I mean, if you're looking at a bank has also to fair value all the loans which they usually do at amortized cost, And also they could argue, okay, we usually do amortized cost and not fair value, so why we should fair value at acquisition? And the same here. And I think there's also then, if a bank is doing that and then, okay, has doing the amortization of the fair value adjustment, is adjusting the interest. And also some people think, okay, it is not a good information because it is, okay, an extraordinary stuff. But also we don't grant an exception for this kind of stuff, and we don't have exceptions for other industries. And I think we have a concept, which is IFRS 3, to doing that. And I think that was one of our main objectives, to bring insurance in line with this, what others are doing. And therefore, I think I agree with staff recommendation. And I clear it is additional work, maybe, and maybe some will not like it, but it's not different to other. Because we have also some investors don't like fair value adjustment in acquisition, but it is not. I want to. It's not a unique thing. But this,
you have to inflict equal pain in equal circumstances.
Mary,
you know, my thinking reaction very much along the lines of what Martin was saying, that well, the specific application issue is seen as an IFRS 17 issue. It really is about whether the acquirer in a business combination is accounting for things based on their conditions, status, terms, et cetera, at the date of acquisition rather than at the original inception of the arrangement when they step in and take over through acquisition, ongoing business, ongoing contracts, et cetera. And when in the past, when we have looked from an IFRS 3 perspective at granting some relief in, you know, in IFRS 3, it has generally been for very specific, limited, and I would say peripheral issues, as opposed to something that relates to an entity's, you know, main business activity. And so I think it was good that the staff took the extra time to do more work on the arguments that were presented in the feedback to the ED, but I remain supportive of the staff recommendation not to make further relief, and as I said, I think it's for many of the reasons that Martin expressed.
I agree with the arguments that Daryl and others have raised in support of the staff recommendation. The other thing that causes me to support the staff recommendation is that even setting aside the IFRS 3 aspects, there's IFRS 17 consequences as well. One is the definition of insurance. It meets the definition of insurance, and if you don't think that this is insurance, then it's a bit odd that it's even in 17. The other thing is that it doesn't follow naturally that the accounting works terribly well, because if there's you don't have the sort of CSM concept, what do you do with the difference? And so we'd have to make other amendments to 17. So it's not as easy as just saying treat it as a, you know, liability for incurred claims. There's other knock-on consequences as well at this late stage.
Can we support the staff recommendation?
14.
Paper 2D discusses the requirement relating to interim financial statements in paragraph B137 of IFRS 17. When developing the exposure draft, the board considered the concern and challenges raised about this requirement, which was developed to avoid entities thinking they need to recalculate amounts previously reported in interim financial statements when they apply IFRS 17 subsequently. The board decided to retain the requirement unchanged, so the exposure draft did not propose any changes to this requirement. Some respondents from each region expressed concern about the cost of implementing and applying this requirement, and particularly about the need to maintain two sets of accounting estimates for entities within a consolidated group with different frequency of reporting, and about the need to change existing accounting practices for interim reporting from a year-to-date basis to a period-to-period basis. So the paper discusses possible ways of amending IFRS 17 to ease IFRS 17 implementation and application without significantly reducing the usefulness of information relative to that which would otherwise result from applying the requirement in paragraph B137 of IFRS 17. The paper discusses three approaches, which were suggested by respondents. Approach one considers deleting paragraph B137 of IFRS 17, and therefore removing the prohibition to change the treatment of accounting estimates made in previous interim financial statements. We think this approach might unduly disrupt implementation for entities that might need to revisit the work they have already done to develop systems and processes to comply with the requirement. Therefore, we do not recommend this approach. Approach two considers introducing an accounting policy choice that would permit an entity to choose whether to change the treatment of accounting estimates made in previous interim financial statements. We recommend this approach because we think it would ease implementation by enabling an entity to assess what is less burdensome from a practical perspective between maintaining two sets of accounting estimates for entities within a consolidated group with different frequency of reporting and recalculating the carrying amount of the contractual service margin and the amount recognized in profit or loss for a subsequent reporting period. We think that introducing a choice would not unduly impair comparability between entities if an entity were to apply consistently the same approach for all the insurance contract issued and the reinsurance contract held. So we recommend the choice is applied at a reporting entity level. In recommending this approach, we also consider that different frequency of reporting already gives rise to differences between entities, even when they are all required to apply paragraph B137 of IFRS 17. And the example in the paper illustrates this. Finally, approach three considers permitting a subsidiary to account for its insurance contract on the basis of the frequency of reporting at the consolidated level. Although helpful to address some of the concern raised, we think that this approach would not significantly reduce IFRS 17 implementation and application cost, and therefore would not recommend this approach. For each approach discussed in the paper, Appendix A provides an assessment against the criteria that the board set for considering possible amendments to IFRS 17. And we think that our recommendation meets the board criteria. Appendix B to the paper provides an assessment of the likely effect of each approach, including a cost-benefit analysis. The question for the board is set out on page 16 of the paper. And with that, I will hand over to the board for the discussion. Thank you.
And Chao?
I agree with staff's proposal. When I did outreach and meet insurance companies, many insurance companies told me that current practice, that they make accounting estimate based on year-to-date basis. So provide this kind of accounting policy choice, I think will not require those companies to change current practice. And I don't think will also significantly loss useful information to users. So I think it's a practical solution to them. And secondly, this approach is also consistent to the general requirements of IS 34. And thirdly, if without this kind of accounting policy choice, all entities within same group, but have different frequency of reporting period, some entities have to keep two sets of accounting estimates. I think it's costly and maybe unnecessary. So I think it provides a very good relief to the insurance companies. And with regard to whether we needed to, delete B137, as Roberta told that because one of the criteria we decided to make amendment is this kind of amendment will not, you know, unduly disrupt the implementation of IFRS 17. For some companies, maybe they have already changed their system, developed their system based on B137. I think it's reasonable to keep that as an option. Thank you.
Rika.
I think I support the staff recommendation, and I think that that option is better address concern raised. So, but I just want to make sure about one thing. I mean, I support the option too, but this decision about our choice of the accounting policies will be made at the parent company level, I mean consolidation level. But if they have a subsidiary that have a different frequency of reporting, in that case, those subsidiary will have to maintain two set of the accounting estimate in even though applying option two by parent company. So I just wondering if staff have already considered if we can add optional choice for subsidiary to have an option three type accounting choice to make it a consistency between what parent company accounting policy basis.
So that would be, incorporating approach three within approach two, if I understand. I think that, approach three that is discussed in the paper is very similar to something that the board considered when developing the exposure draft that would substantially extend the application of the requirement in IFRS 17 to any type of reporting that is not defined in IAS 34 or elsewhere in IFRS standard. And I think that the board rejected this suggestion that was raised by some of the stakeholders because it would result in different entities developing different definition of interim reports. And as you said, probably this approach three would not address all the concern raised about the need to keep two set of books because the paper also noted that there might be other differences between a subsidiary reporting and the group reporting. So when analyzing the comment letter, I think that some respondents commented on this decision and conclusion of the board before, but we haven't identified any new point to reconsider, to further explore, I would say, this approach.
Thank you.
Beryl?
I also support where the staff have landed. I think as a starting point, the relief, like, or the alignment with current systems that we're providing by giving the alternative approach under B137, I think does address a lot of concerns that stakeholders had expressed around the systems, the way the systems are set up, and et cetera. And I would agree with the staff conclusion that we're not resulting in it doesn't result in a loss of significant useful information. I also agree with Zhen Chao's argument that one of the things to think about is that we set out not to disrupt current implementation process, and I think that's a valid reason for offering the choice. But I'd actually go further than that. It's certainly my understanding that in practice there are actually two approaches that entities take, typically driven by regulators in their particular jurisdictions. And so those who liked B137 like B137 not just because they'd already started to do work on it, but because that's actually the way they do it and the way they calculate it. And so I think we, as much as optionality is not always a great thing, I think in this circumstance, if we're going to make the change, I think it's incumbent on us to keep the previous B137 in place.
Nick.
That's Thank you. So I feel less comfortable with the staff recommendation here. And it's, for me, it's a trade-off between pragmatism, through which we can ease the process of implementation, and complexity. And my test is, how easy could I explain this to a user? So first of all, we have issues around comparability with the existing requirements. And on top of that, we then layer an accounting policy choice. And I accept there may be no loss of information to a user, but to prove that and to convince them, I would struggle. So I'm torn up in my own mind about this, how weighing up this pragmatic, we need to get this over the hurdle of this and easy implementation, but against complexity. So I'm not sure.
Gary,
thank you. Perhaps unlike Nick, I'm very sure. Whether you like a different answer or not, I think there's no other practical answer than the staff's recommendation. Is that I think if you go to our fundamental test, to make these modifications, no fundamental change to 17, or don't be disruptive, and don't affect the effective date. So we're looking for it. You fail at least two of those. My instincts tell me, however companies report on an interim basis is how they've been building their support systems and compliance towards adopting IFRS 17. And if you report only semi-annually, it might be a little bit different than if you report quarterly, where your world exists in 90-day increments and you largely have to work with the systems, tools, and internal capabilities that you've got today. I think we really need to be honest with ourselves and our constituents. The interim reporting has never been as well developed by design as full year reporting, so it's almost and frequently an afterthought or a non-thought as we write our standards. Nonetheless, it's the reality of the world that people exist in and have to report. And I think we can debate all day long, is interim periods, discrete periods, or just portions of a year to date. And if you're looking to get this done quickly disrupt the effective date, not disrupt ongoing implementation efforts, reopening the debate is what is the nature of interim period is inconsistent with that. So I think you get the right answer, and reasonably well received. We want to reopen the larger fundamentals of what IAS 34 is trying to accomplish. I think that's its own project, and I didn't see that come through in last time agenda consultation as something that's critical that the board address.
Are we ready to vote? Yes.
13.
Vitalina?
Send the paper to Eve. At the December 2019 meeting, the board tentatively finalized the proposed amendments in relation to the expected recovery of insurance acquisition cash flows. As mentioned at that meeting, the staff planned to discuss the transition aspect of this topic in a separate paper. Agenda paper 2E discusses the requirements for an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows on transition and in a transfer of insurance contracts or a business combination. Overall, in this paper, the staff proposes requirements to recognize and measure an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows on transition and in a transfer of insurance contracts or a business combination, aligning the requirements at the transition and acquisition dates with IFRS 17 subsequent measurement requirements. In addition, in this paper, the staff addressed respondents' feedback to provide transition relief for the measurement of an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows when it is impracticable to measure the asset retrospectively. The analysis in the paper is structured in five sections, each with a question to the board, and so I plan to introduce each section in turn. Turning now to the first section of the paper, in paragraph 1619, on retrospective application and approaches if retrospective application is impracticable. In this section, the staff noted that the standard did not provide specific requirements on recognizing and measuring an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows at transition. Therefore, the staff recommend the board to clarify that an entity should recognize an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows at the transition date retrospectively, as if FRS 17 had always been applied. The staff acknowledged that for some entities, it might be impracticable to apply a full retrospective approach to measure the asset. Therefore, the staff recommended the board to require an entity to apply a modified retrospective approach or fair value approach if and only if it is impracticable for the entity to apply FRS 17 retrospective to measure the asset for insurance acquisition cash flows. Questions 1 and 2 are set out on page 7 of the paper, and I will now hand over to the board for discussion of retrospective application and approaches when a retrospective application is impracticable.
Mary?
I just want to test my understanding, having asked a question of the staff bit in the run-up to this, about question 2, really, and it is about, as I thought about this, I was trying to think about whether the choice with respect to the insurance acquisition cash flows is an entirely independent choice, you know, of the modified retro or the fair value approach versus other transition choices. And as I thought through the feedback I got back, my understanding is that there are three possible scenarios, that the insurance acquisition cash flows relate to groups that have been recognized already. If that's the case, then there isn't a separate asset and it would just be included in the group. If the insurance acquisition cash flows relate to a group that has not been recognized at all, there is no other kind of interactive or potentially complementary accounting transition choice to make for the related group. So it would be an entirely independent choice. And if, however, you're sitting in between those where the insurance acquisition cash flows relate to a group that has started to be recognized but is not complete, let's say, you know, it was recognized, let's say, a month before the reporting date, and the entity expects to add to that group, then we have an existing requirement for transition that says if full retrospective if full retrospective is impracticable, then for the group you have to do either the modified retrospective or fair value. So my understanding is that for those that fall into that last group, which is the one that sits in the middle, you know, of the either all the group and none of the group, you do not have an independent choice for that. It's the election that you make for the group that applies, rather than saying, well, you make one decision with respect to other aspects of the group, and then you make a separate choice, which may or may not be the same for that. Now, if that's correct, do you think that we need to be more explicit about that in the drafting of the final? So first, is it correct? And if so, what, if anything, do we have to say about that?
It is correct,
okay.
Absolutely.
That's good.
So that's good. And I think we will, when we do the drafting, we'll make it clear, you know, that IFRS 17 is already clear that when you're looking at transition, you're looking at it at a sort of group level for each mm-hmm. group. And we will make sure that the way we draft the words about the insurance acquisition cash flow asset, that is tied into that same notion about the groups. So,
or really that it's a kind of free choice only if none of the group is recognized.
Yes. I mean, I'd say that what you've got is you've got a free choice for each group. But, you know, you have to make a choice for a group, mm-hmm. and you can't do some of a group one way and another bit of the group a different way. It's got to be the same approach for each group.
Okay. Thank you.
But you do have to use all the retrospective information you've got, right?
Yes.
So it's not like you suddenly start ignoring stuff you otherwise
would. Yeah,
that is also true, yes.
Can you vote for the question separately?
Yes.
Question 1.
14. The second section of the paper in paragraphs 20-25 discusses the recognition and measurement of an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows in the modified retrospective approach. The staff recommend the board require an entity in the modified retrospective approach to measure an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows using the information available at the transition date. As a simplification compared to the full retrospective approach, the modified approach avoids the need to revise the estimates retrospectively. To align the transition requirements with the subsequent measurement requirements, in the modified retrospective approach, the staff also recommend the board require an entity to adjust the contractual service margin of the groups of insurance contracts that are recognized at the transition date by deducting the amount of insurance acquisition cash flows allocated to those groups. The staff also recommend, in the modified retrospective approach, in the absence of reasonable and supportable information to apply the modification, to require an entity to determine an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows and the respective CSM adjustment for the groups of contracts that are recognized at the transition date as nil. This modification would prevent an entity from not being allowed to use the modified retrospective approach and having to use the fair value approach solely because of a lack of information about insurance acquisition cash flows. Questions 3 and 4 are set out on pages 9 and 10 of the paper. I will now hand over to the board for discussion of the retrospective approach.
Sue?
I agree with the staff recommendations. I just had one thing I just wanted to confirm on 3B. So if I look at the words at near the top of page 10 on the little B where we talk about the contracts that are expected to be recognised after the transition date, I forgot to bring the ED with me, but from memory, in the ED, the insurance acquisition cash flow amendments that we were proposing were focusing on renewals only, not all future contracts. That's the intention here too. We just haven't got the final polished wording here just yet.
That's right. So when we're talking about using the method of allocation they're going to apply going forward, that I think we set out those words somewhere in the... So in paragraph 11, that gives us the words that we had in the exposure draft about that allocation, and that, if you look at 11A2, that is focusing on the renewals of the contract. And so that's exactly the groups that we would be expecting that you would be allocating this transition asset to.
Okay. I support that. I think it would be good when we do assuming we vote for this, to make sure we're consistent in the words
clear.
So it's clear it's the same population we're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay, any more comments? No? Question 3?
14.
And 4? And 4?
14. Now moving to the third section of the paper, in paragraph 26-28, which describes the measurement of an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows in the fair value transition approach. An asset for insurance acquisition cash flows reflects the right of the entity to recover insurance acquisition cash flows from premiums of insurance contracts originated before the transition date but not yet recognized at the transition date, or the right of the entity to obtain future contracts, including the expected renewals, after the transition date, without paying again insurance acquisition cash flows the entity has already paid. The staff recommend that in the fair value transition approach, the board require an entity to measure an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows as the amount of insurance acquisition cash flows that the entity would incur at the transition date to obtain the aforementioned rights. Question 5 is set out on page 12 of the paper, and I will now hand over to the board for discussion of the fair value transition approach.
Darrell?
So I agree with what we're trying to achieve here. I'm very comfortable with the direction of travel. I am concerned, though, with some of the words that we're specifically putting in, and I think if I go to the recommendation, specifically the portion that says if the entity had not already paid acquisition cash flows to obtain the rights. And I think my concern here would be that, as I have previously seen the fair value approach, it is entirely intended as a prospective approach. So it looks forward and says that I look totally at the value of the rights at that point in time at which I purchased it based on what's going to happen in the future. What these words seem to be doing is setting up a retrospective proof, if you like. I have to prove that I paid something in the past. And I'm not sure, firstly, I'm not sure that's consistent with the approach, but I also have a concern that there may be circumstances in which people are unable to prove that, and then I'm not quite sure where they go from there. So I would probably be comfortable with the proposal, but without those words.
Right. I think what we're trying to say here is that for the fair value approach, the entity, first of all, needs to identify the rights. And when it comes to the right to recover insurance contracts, insurance acquisition cash flows from the premiums of the contracts which already originated, for this case, yes, the entity needs to have vast information to identify those assets for insurance acquisition cash flows. But when it comes to the renewals, yes, you're right. If the entity has the right for the renewals, it doesn't necessarily need to have vast information to measure the fair value of those renewals. So I think we'll just try to be probably clearer in the drafting of the final standard.
Yes, I think it's a question of we have those words in there because you do need to identify the rights that you're measuring under this fair value approach. And certainly for future contracts that aren't renewals, you know, we don't want an entity on transition measuring those at some sort of current value because it would incorporate all sorts of internally generated goodwill and whatnot. So we thought we needed to pin down exactly what rights we were talking about. But for the future contracts that are renewals, we think that the fact that they are expected renewals of existing contracts, that gives you enough to identify that right. And so for those renewals, we don't think we need those words. So we will in the drafting, we will pin down exactly when we think we need them and when we think we don't need them, and I think that will address your concern.
Okay, can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
14. Section of the paper in paragraphs 30-33, which discusses an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows recognized at the acquisition date when an entity acquires insurance contracts in a transfer of insurance contracts or in a business combination within the scope of IFRS 3. The staff think that an entity should recognize such an asset separately from other intangible assets recognized applying IFRS 3, for example, from a customer relationship intangible asset. The staff recommend the board require an entity to measure an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows at fair value at the acquisition date. This approach aligns the measurement of an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows with the overall IFRS 3 business combination requirements. Question 6 is set out on page 13 of the paper, and I will now hand over to the board for the discussion of business combination requirements.
Daryl.
So it's sort of a derivation of the previous point, I think. It's not included in the recommendation, so I'm very comfortable with the recommendation as worded. But 31 also has this sort of history to look, this need to look back in paragraph 31 at the end of that. But since it's not in the recommendation, I'm probably comfortable with the way the recommendation is worded.
Do we support the staff's recommendation?
14. Last section of the paper in paragraphs 34-36 discusses the impairment consideration on transition to IFRS 17. In this section, the staff recommend the board clarify that for the assets for insurance acquisition cash flows recognized at the transition date, an entity is not required to apply the recoverability assessment requirement in paragraph 28D of the exposure draft retrospectively, that is, for the periods that occurred earlier than the transition date. The staff note that at the transition date, the entity will need to apply the recoverability assessment applying the requirements of paragraph 28D of the exposure draft in case facts and circumstances that indicate possible impairment exist. Question 7 is set out on page 14 of the paper, and I will now hand over to the board for discussion.
Do we agree with the staff recommendation?
14. To the end of this topic. And the staff has been very persuaded. Thank you very much.